My name is Tasha and I'm an alcoholic. And I have the pleasure and the honor to introduce our speaker tonight, Brett, with 8 years and 18 days. And his advice to the newcomer is to be honest and especially with yourself. And his home group is the Bridge Street Drunks. And what has kept him sober so long is continue to learn and grow and trust in God and working with others. So without further ado, Brett.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brett, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like you all to thank Jim, my warm-up speaker. Hey, Merry Christmas, everybody. I did something kind of unique for me, because usually I just talk off the cuff because I like to talk and I usually don't have any problem running my mouth. But I wanted to stay kind of focused tonight and have a little bit of humor and levity here tonight. And it is Christmas, and not get too serious, but stay on point and carry the best message I can possibly carry. So first and foremost, I would like to thank our active duty military members in the military and our veterans, the military members that there's thousands of them around the world that aren't going to be with their families today. And as a veteran, and there's other veterans in here, they know how important their job is, and they take it serious. It's a dangerous, dangerous job keeping this country safe. So I'd like to salute them and say Merry Christmas to them. And with that, I want to give a tribute to my sponsor, who passed away a couple months ago, Elgin Martin. Wonderful man. Miss him dearly. It's hard to believe he's not here anymore. That man took me through the steps. Called me on my shit. Excuse my language. I was going to say excuse my French, but that's English. And was there for me whenever I needed him. Anytime I called him, he either answered or got right back to me as soon as he could. And anytime I needed him, there was a time I didn't have a ride up to Stanford University for a PET scan for a follow-up on my cancer. And without hesitation, he said, "I'll be there at a certain time in the morning. I got this." And he took me there without hesitation. Great man, great sponsor. He helped a lot of us here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So with that, it tells me in the big book of alcoholics. Oh, I wanted to say one more thing. I was up at the VA the other day with my friend Leon right here. And when I was sitting down in the lobby, these young ladies came by, and they're from West Leadership. They're CV West Leadership students, and they gave me this little Christmas card, and I almost went into tears. I don't know if I'm even going to be able to read it. It said, "I was told that a superhero fights for the people, so to me, you are my superhero. Thank you for fighting for us, CV West Leadership students." That really touched my heart. So it tells me in the big book, it tells me that I need to share in a general way my experience, strength, and hope. So I'm going to do about 10 minutes. Jim took up most of my time, so we're going to go late tonight. Two beers. I'm going to start my... Oh, I got to set it first, huh? I'm going to do 10 minutes on what led me to drinking and how I come about to lead into my alcoholism. I was born and raised in Maine, on the other side of the country. And I was born to two alcoholics, mother and father. They were both serious alcoholics. They were totally dysfunctional, like the 93% of the other families here in the United States. And the other 7%, they don't know where they're at. We're all dysfunctional. So when I was 5 years old, my mother and father divorced and sent me and a brother and a sister off to live with my dad's parents, my grandfather and grandmother. And shortly after that, a couple of years after that, my grandfather had become my hero, my male idol. He was everything to me. Things that I didn't have at a young child from my dad or my mom. My mom came out here to California, and my dad went to some girlfriend's house and moved in with her, and I don't know what was going on there, but I'm with my grandparents, and he became my everything. And about 2 or 3 years after I went to live with him, he came down with stage 4 colon cancer. And when I was 10 years old, he came home from the hospital, and he was sitting there at home. He had a colostomy bag and all that stuff. And, this is back in 1968, so medical treatments and things weren't like they are today. And I remember as a young boy sitting on his lap and putting my arms around his neck. And when I had to use my head, I used to disarm back then. So I had my arms around his neck, and I would say, "Papa, Papa." We were raised to take care of our elders when they were sick, and I said, "What can I do for you? What can I do for you?" And he would just blow me off, and he'd say, there was a time he said, "Just go out and be a kid. I don't, just be a kid. Don't worry about me." And so this one particular day, I was doing the same thing. I was on his lap with my arms around his neck, going, "Is there anything I can do for you? Is there anything I can do for you?" And then all of a sudden, his body went limp. And he died of a massive coronary with me sitting on his lap. And I was 10 years old. And that had a profound, profound impact on my life. And I also attribute to my abandonment issues between my parents and my grandfather, even though he didn't want to die and leave me, but it was the same kind of a detachment. And so 2 years later, He had a bunch of guns. He was a big weapons guy back in Maine, rifles and handguns and stuff. We hunted and fished and camped and all those kind of things. And so weapons were not uncommon. And matter of fact, safety wasn't that great a big deal of an issue either. They'd just come in from hunting and take their rifles, long guns, and lean them up in the corner and tell us to leave those things alone. And that was our hunter safety course. Don't touch him. And we said, "Oh, we're not going to touch him." And we didn't. Well, he had 5 sons and 5 daughters. And when he died, his sons, including my dad, came in and gathered up all his guns and got him out of the house. And unbeknownst to us, he had a 38 snub nose hidden in his closet, loaded. And one day, my 6-year-old brother, I was 12 years old, was down in my grandmother's room and funneling around. She was knitting or something, and he found that gun. And he come running down the hall and he slipped and fell. I'm sitting there and I'm watching him. I see something in his hand. He slips and falls, and the gun goes off and hits him right here and blows the back of his head out and kills him. I was in 7th grade, and it wasn't too long, a few weeks after that, I had a friend who knew I was struggling really bad, came up to me at school, and he said, "Hey, I got some wine hidden out behind the school." He said, "At lunchtime, you want to go out and have some?" And I said, "Sure, I'll go have some wine." And he had some Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, some Ripple, some Thunderbird, which is not really even wine, it's just chemicals. I went out there and we drank some wine, and all of a sudden, everything became okay. Life became okay. All the heartache and the abandonment issues and everything I was going through became okay. And I didn't know what was happening to me at the time. And as a few years went by the time I was 15 years old, I was drinking pretty much every weekend, if not almost every day that I could get alcohol. And I was also using some other things, some dry goods, we call them around here, some powders and some leafy green things. And I had become, at 15 years old, I had become obsessed with drinking and using drugs that I thought every, I remember you saying stuff like, you only live once, might as well just party till you puke. And that's how I lived in my teens. And I was a good athlete, believe me. You wouldn't know it today, but I was a state champion gymnast in my junior and senior year in high school. And you wouldn't saw me walk up here. I can barely walk up here, so picture that. I used to party really hard, never realizing that it was going to lead to a lifelong problem with drugs and alcohol. Ever. Never even crossed my mind, never even considered the thought that. And then I joined the military after high school, and I'm in the Navy, and I'm 29 years old now, and I'm drinking hard. They taught us how to drink real well there. And I was drinking really hard, and I got in some trouble drinking, and they sent me to a rehab center in Norfolk, Virginia. It's called Alcohol Rehabilitation Center Level 3. It's a 6-week program. And this is kind of where my journey, it was 1987, this is kind of where my journey with alcohol, with the program, the big book, alcoholism, understanding all that stuff started to funnel into my life, but I had no clue it was funneling into my life. You understand what I'm saying? It's seeping in, but I don't know it's having an effect that's an impact on my life that's going to take hold later on in life, because I didn't stay sober. I stayed sober for 7 years out of spite. Because they told me if I got in trouble drinking again, I was going to lose my military career. So I said, well, I just won't drink. And I didn't until about 4 months before I retired and I started drinking again. And then I went on an 11-year run. But back to where I was at. In that rehabilitation center, it was run by the Navy. There was everything from captains, admirals, to petty officers. I was a first-class petty officer at the time. And it was a two-level place, and they had a room kind of way smaller than this, but they had about 20, 25 chairs set up with in a circle, and they had one chair smack in the middle. And remember, it's my first morning there, and I come down to go have breakfast, and I go into the room where they're going to have this, where they told me to be, and so I show up, and all these guys are sitting around, and I don't know their rank, their name, or nothing, never met them before. I came in during the middle of the evening before, and they told me to sit in that middle chair, so I sat in that middle chair, and this one gentleman goes, "Why are you here?" And I said, "Well, I got in trouble drinking." He went, And the next guy goes, "So tell me again why you're here." And he goes, I go, "Well, I got in trouble drinking." And he said, And that went on. It went on. And finally, I think it was next to probably the last guy, he goes, "Tell us again why you're here." And I said, "God darn." I said, "I have a drinking problem, and I get in trouble when I drink." And he said, "No, you do not have a drinking problem. You have a selfish, self-centered, and you're full of self-pity. And that's your problem. And if you can overcome that, you can stay sober. You can find a way to stay sober. Understand who you are. Understand that you're an alcoholic." I didn't know it that day. I had never read the big book. Didn't know anything about it. I can tell you this, coming into AA this last time here, I'm reading the big book, I'm reading it, and it says, "You're selfish, self-centered, and you're full of self-pity. This might be your problem." I went, maybe if I would have understood that 32 years ago, I might have stayed sober, but I didn't. And so I didn't stay sober, and I went back out for 11 years. And I managed to retire from the Navy. My wife and I up in China Lake, California, moved back to Maine. And we bought a home back there, and I had already started drinking again. And for about a year, she was telling me, "If you don't stop drinking, I'm going to leave you. If you don't stop drinking, I'm going to leave you. If you don't stop drinking, I'm going to leave you." And I went, You're not going to leave me. You need me. And so I was all full of ego and thought I was hot and sexy and stuff. And she's not going to leave me. I got a good job, good money. Why is she going to leave me? She can't live without me. So I went to work out of town. And my dad, we lived right down the street from my dad in a little town called Mattawamkeag, Maine. And he calls me up one day at work and he says, "Your wife's gone." I said, "She left me?" He goes, "Yeah, she left you." Not only did she leave you, she took everything you own and booked off, and we don't know where she's gone. And so that was in 1996. And as far as I know, we're still legally married today. We're doing everything in our power to keep this marriage together. I haven't seen her in 22 years. Haven't talked to her in 22 years, and as far as I know, we're still legally married. So I can look her up on the internet, and she lives in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I live out here, and the marriage is working just fine. We don't argue, we don't fight, we have no problems about where we're going to dinner, and matter of fact, I've been eating alone for a lot of years. So, there came a time that I crossed over a line. The line that's all we would talk about in here is like, I was having fun. I was partying. I was godless. I didn't have a spiritual connection with anything. I had no morality, no morals, no identification on who I was. I was running Harry Carey out there, and all I could do was drink and use drugs. That's all I wanted to do, and if everybody would just leave me alone, I'd be just fine. And if you just stopped getting on my butt, I'd be just fine. My mother said to me before she, God rest her soul, before she passed away, she said, "You know, I'd like you a lot better if you'd quit drinking." So I quit drinking for about 4 or 5 months, and she didn't like me any better. And I said, "You told me if I quit drinking, you'd like me." And she goes, "You're still an asshole." And so that comes to another issue with Alcoholics Anonymous and working the program, and that's we solved the drink problem, but we're still left with ourselves. We're still stuck with us. And drinking wasn't my problem. It was my solution to everything that had happened to me in my life. If I had 3 or 4 hours, I could go into a lot more stuff, but I don't want to, and it's hard remembering all that stuff, and it's not fun remembering all that stuff. But so in 2005, I came back into, back out here in California, and I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous at January 25th of 2005. And I started coming, I went to PAR over in Porterville, and I started, I did 90 days over there, and I got out of PAR, and I didn't have a home, I had a military retirement, I had an income, but I didn't have a house or a car. And I had a girlfriend that I had 3 kids with while I was married to a gal in Manchester, New Hampshire. And talk about a wreckage of my future. So I love those kids to death, by the way. this gal and I ran into each other back up in Three Rivers, California, and she was 22 years younger than I was. I was 40 years old, and she was 18. And I did everything I could to force her off. Leave me alone. I'm too old for you. But this mysterious disease snuck up and hit me in the back of my head, and I got drunk one night, and really drunk, and ran into her at a party, and the rest is history. You can leave that to your imagination. I ended up having 3 kids with her, the last one when I was 46, the first one when I was 42, and the third one the middle one when I was 45. That plays into my story, too. I stayed sober for 5.5 years. I became the manager of the Alano Club here in town, and got to know a lot of people. I tried to be, I always liked it when somebody liked me. Because that was my goal in life, was for you to like me. It was never for me to like me. It was always for you to like me. And if you didn't like me, I'd bleed all over you like you cut me or something. So there's a thing that I read the other day. I don't know where I read it. It says, if you don't heal what hurt you, you're going to bleed on people that didn't even cut you. And I did that here in the program. If I didn't get my way, if you don't do the things that I want you to do the way I want you to do them, I get resentful to you. Just like Jim up here talking all night long. He's cutting into my message, man. I got to resent. I'm going to have to go home and work a 10-step on him. I love Jim, man. Jim used to teach my two youngest daughters, by the way. And they went to his school. So here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had to do something. I'm gonna go through some stuff, and I'm gonna spend the rest of my night. That's what happened to me, and that's how I drank. I was a pig when I drank and used. I was an absolute pig. I didn't know when to stop. I couldn't stop. I lost the power of choice. I did not have any control over the drink. Once I took my first drink, all bets were off. I couldn't tell you when I was going to stop, what I was going to do, or who I was going to do it to, and how I was going to rob you, but I'm sure one of those things were going to happen. I wasn't the most honest person in the world. I didn't have any morality. I was a liar, a cheater, and a thief. The nature of my disease. And no moral compass whatsoever. So if you have something and I want it, I'm going to get it from you some way. And I get really, really good at it. Really good at it. And so I was left with a dilemma. The big book says, lack of power is your dilemma. I had no power. The alcohol stopped working for me. I would drink and drink and drink, and it wouldn't chase all those feelings away. I wasn't good looking, 10-foot tall, and bulletproof anymore. All those feelings of insecurity stayed. The more alcohol I put in my system, the worse I felt. Then it cut to the point where I wouldn't even get a hangover. I'd get up in the morning and I go, I'm not going to drink today. I'm tired. I'm fed up. And I'd say that for, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes, and then all of a sudden the bottle would come out. And then I'd be angry and I'd be upset and I'd go, what is wrong with me? Why can't I stop? Why can't I stop? Why in God's earth? It's so hard. I had a guy talking to me yesterday. He's not in the program. As a matter of fact, it's my daughter's cousin. We're out at his house for a Christmas dinner yesterday afternoon, and they drink, and we're talking about it, and he says to me, I don't know what the hell's wrong with you guys. You can make a choice. You can choose not to drink. Just have some willpower. Apparently, he's not an alcoholic. It was painfully obvious he was not an alcoholic, because if I had the power of choice, I wouldn't be standing here, that's for sure. Because this is the last place I want to be on Christmas Day. I'm still in yesterday. So there's some things that have to happen here. You know, Elgin used to tell me that you never have to drink again, even if you want to. And a previous sponsor years ago used to tell me that, too. Even if you want to. And I'd go, I don't think I believe that. I don't know if I really believe that, because if you knew who I was, if you knew the troubles I've been through, you knew what I went through in my life, you would know that I have no choice but drink. I have no choice but drink. So tell me I don't have to drink again even if I want to? Well, dude, I want to drink. Because that's what alcoholics do. We drink. I want to. And but then he'd go on to say, he goes, there's some things you have to do here. The first thing you have to do is make it up in your mind that you don't ever want to drink again. You have to have a psychic change. The big book talks about a psychic change. And until I have that, until I get completely 100% honest with myself about who I am, what it's doing to my life, and wanting to change it, I have no hope whatsoever of staying sober for a day or an hour, let alone a day. So he'd say, so you got to have that change of mind. You got to have a understanding that you want a new way of life. You want to live differently. Do you want to keep getting what you're getting? Or do you want to do something different and get something new? Well, in the big book, it says we can go on to the bitter end or we can accept spiritual help. That's one of the beginnings. So we have these 12 steps. The first one says I'm powerless over alcohol. It doesn't say I'm powerless over my life. It says I'm powerless over alcohol. And my life is unmanageable because of it. I didn't have any problem knowing I was powerless over alcohol, but I just couldn't identify that my life was unmanageable because of it. You know, there was a lot of crazy things going on. I'm married to the woman for 22 years and married to her since 1987 and I haven't seen her in 22 years. That might be a good indication that your life is not, you know. I'm speaking at an AA meeting. There's another good indication. You all are sitting in an AA meeting. That might be a sign. You know, what's his name? Bill Engvall says, here's your sign. You're in an AA meeting. Unless you had nothing else or you're here supporting a friend, you might want to look at that. So, and then there's step two. It says, came to believe that power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. I don't know about you, but I never thought I was insane. I never once thought I was insane, ever. Even through all the craziness I've been through, I never one time thought I was insane. But that's not the insane they're talking about in the Big Book of Alcoholics. What they're talking about is this crap that we do when we're out there drinking and all the manipulation and all the lying and all the cheating and all the affairs on the wife and the wife having on the husband and all that stuff. That's insane. Normal people don't do those things. So a power greater than myself can restore that to a sane way. It doesn't say... it says, restore me to sanity. It doesn't say, keep me insane. It says, restore me to sanity. And then step three, it says, we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. Those are the first three steps. You all, if you haven't done the steps, you just did the first three steps. All you got to do is say, I'm an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. I need to be restored to sanity and I'm willing to look at that, believe in something greater than me. And I'm going to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And so they break it down real simple here. They step one. I can't. Step two, he can. And step three, I think I'll let him. He can. Who's he? It's a God of my own understanding. And then we get into the inventory steps, 4 through 7. And that's where the real nitty-gritty work gets done. And that's where we get to look at ourselves and we look at all our woes and all the things that we've done and all the resentments that we created throughout our lives. And I'll show you, I'll hate you for the rest of your life while you go home and sleep. And I'm over here awake, wide awake, going, son of a gun, why are you home sleeping? I'm still pissed off at you. You know, I'm going to take poison and expect you to die. You know, So we look at those things in the step work, and then we get into the sixth and seventh step, which are very, very important steps, and they're character defect steps and shortcoming steps, and without me looking at who I am and my character defects and willing to have God remove those from my character, from me, which, by the way, he's still working on me. Just letting you know, he hasn't worked here. I got an app on my phone that says character defects, and it comes up with 93 different character defects, and I think I got them all. So don't look it up, because you're going to have more character defects than you ever knew. Hey, there's also a great book. It's not an AA approved literature book. It's called Drop the Rock, and it deals with the sixth and seventh step. And there are a lot of AA sponsors who ask their sponsees to read that book when they're working their sixth and seventh step, and it's a great, great book, and it really, really helps you understand who you are and why you are what you are, and what you can do about it. And then, in the eighth step, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing. We make the list of all the people we have harmed, and we become willing. Doesn't say we have to do it right then. It says we become willing to make an amends to them all. So I make the list, and I ask God to make me willing to look. There's a lot of people I don't want to make amends to. My mom being one of them. I love my mom. I want to tell you a little story, and I've got 10 minutes left, and we'll probably go about 15 minutes late, so it's Christmas Day. You guys will be all right with that, right? It's my Christmas present to you. I'm living up in the desert, California, before I joined the Navy, and I was doing all kinds of things. I was drinking real heavy, and I was using these dry goods. And there's one thing you should know about me: when I'm drinking and using dry goods, cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, and all those things, when I mix those two, I come up with this very, very rare intelligence. I rarely ever use any. And so my mom went on vacation to the Mardi Gras in New Orleans and with her boyfriend. And she had a beautiful home and nice furniture, antiques and stuff. And I had a friend named Buford. And Buford and I had a little yellow Honda Geo or Fiesta or something like that. And we had all kinds of crap. And one night, we used to play hacky sack. Anybody know what hacky sack is? We were really good at it because we'd up all night playing hacky sack. And so one night, it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we decided, we knew my mom was out of town. This is how sick I am. I went into her house and stole everything she owned. Everything, including her clothes, her bra, her panties, her shoes, her dressers, her mirrors, her paintings, her couches, everything. This is a true story. I swear to God, it's a true story. We loaded everything up in my truck, and we went off to a flea market and sold it all off. And she came home from New Orleans, and the police, because she called the police, and her house was completely empty. Maybe something fell on the floor, whatever. And the police told her, said, this is an inside job. She goes, no, my son would never do that. He'd never do that. I don't care how messed up he is. He would never do that to me. And she said, they never arrested me, never did anything. And about 25 years later, I said, Mom, do you know that time you came home from New Orleans and all your stuff was missing? She goes, yeah. And I go, I did that. And I'm sorry. And she goes, I know you did that. You're supposed to be mad at me now. You're supposed to hate me and throw things at me. And she goes, no, I know you did that. It's painfully obvious you did it. I said, why didn't you ever say anything? She says, because you're my son and I love you. That's a true story. That's how messed up I was. She passed away in 2008 of cirrhosis of the liver. My dad passed away in 2009 of pancreatic cancer from alcoholism. And I battled cancer twice, not because of alcoholism, because I was over in Desert Storm over in 1991 in the middle of the oil well fires and all that, all those oil wells and breathing all that crap in. I was building explosive packages for Red Adair, this company who were blowing the oil head off the wells to put the fires up. There was 6,000 to 8,000 oil wells on fire. I was an explosives expert in the military, and they had me over there for 18 months building these explosive packages to blow these heads off these oil wells. And we put those oil wells out in about 18 months, most of them. And I came back, and a month later, I was diagnosed with sinus cancer. And I since had 64 surgeries, chemotherapy, and radiation on my sinuses. And in September of 2017, I had a complete septorhinoplasty done, which is, anybody who's a nurse knows that's a complete, nose was completely rebuilt. They took a cartilage out of my rib and rebuilt my nose. And then last year, I had stage 3 tracheal cancer, and I had chemo and radiation again, and then I've had 2 strokes and 64 surgeries. And I'm not telling you that to go, wow, well, that guy's been a lot and through a lot. No, I want to tell you that because Albert talked about it today, and I love Albert, and I get such a good message from him. And him and I have been through a lot of stuff together, man, a lot of stuff. And I tell you that because not one single time did I ever think about going out and drinking during these last 8 years through all that crap? Not one time. And why didn't I go out and drink? Want to drink? Why? This is the best it's going to get for me. It doesn't get any better than this. I'm going to limp around, and this hand doesn't work, and I'm going to do that for the rest of my life. It's not poor me, poor me. It's like find something else that you're good at. I'm back in physical therapy today. They're really working me hard. My leg is getting really strong again. I'm doing everything. And these things are a direct result of staying sober and coming to AA, carrying a message the best I can, working with others, and trusting God that He has my back. He has my six, as we say in the military. He has my six. And so trust God, clean house, and work with others. And there's a lot of stuff I wrote down that I wanted to go to page this and page 20 and page 47. I'll go to page 47 right now. The top of the page of page 47 says this. It says, therefore, when we speak of God, we speak of God, a God of your own understanding, our own understanding. What does that mean? I got 2 minutes. I'm going to tell you what it means. It means this. Here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that God that you knew as a kid growing up, I grew up with that God. My grandmother used to take me to church, Baptist church in Millinocket, Maine. She put this little blue velvet short pantsuit on with a bow tie, and she'd bring my little blonde ass over to church, and she'd put me in the pew, and if I smiled or made a wise crack or fidgeted, I'd get slapped up the backside of the head, and you're going straight to hell for that. That's the God I grew up with. It wasn't fun. I had a healthy fear of going straight to hell. Here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we get to pick our God. We get to design a God of our own understanding. It talks about, that's our out. Step 3 and step 11 here in Alcoholics Anonymous are magnificent steps because it gives you an out. If you don't believe in God, you don't have to. You can develop a God. You can use a group as your God. You can, but get a God. If you want a new way of life, Rely on something other than you, because guess where you're at right now? You're up here in Christmas Eve listening to me. You need a God in your life. So it's really important. It's the whole basis of this book is finding a God of your own understanding, connecting with a God, a spiritual connection, a maintenance of having a maintenance of that spiritual connection, who will be there for you when, even when you don't know it. There's going to come a time, and it happens to every single one of us, that we get ourselves in a situation and it's just us. And we're posed with a dilemma. Do I drink or do I ask God for help right now? Because he's the only one that's going to help you. And I found for me that if I pause and I go, I'm having these really, really strange feelings. I've got 8 years sobriety. I should have 32, but that don't mean nothing. I've got 8 years, and I feel like I want to drink. And I've done all the stuff I'm supposed to do in here. And I want to tell you, I'm not the same person I was a year ago, let alone 8 years ago. I've started to grow up. My emotions have started. When I started drinking at 12 years old, I became emotionally stunted. My mental maturity, my maturity was 12 years old. I'm 61 years old now. I have the body of a 61-year-old and the mind of a 12-year-old, the sense of humor of a 12-year-old. So I do. But you know what?
Twelve-year-olds down like that.
I know some 12-year-olds going to come in and smack me around and say, dude, stop putting us down like that. I do. I like to goof off. I like to have fun. I come into a meeting. I walk through the door and I say, tonight you're going to straighten up and you're going to fly right and you're not going to fidget around and you're not going to have your grandmother smack you in the back of the head from heaven and you're not going to crosstalk and you're not going to do all these things. I'm going to just be just fine. And then you guys start goofing around and I can't shut down. It's all your fault. So then everybody's going, Brett, you need to stop. Stop it. I do it down at my home group at Bridge Street. I walk in there and I'm going, I'm not doing it today. I don't even get into the door. And Jeff's down there going, you need help, Brett. But you know what? The good news is I'm a lot better. And I'm going to continue to get better. And I'm going to continue to grow. And I'm going to continue to do exactly what it says to do in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what's keeping me sober today. Working this program to the best of my ability and being honest with myself and who I am. Have no illusions that I can ever go out and drink and use again. Ever. Not ever again. So every day, 24 hours a day, I get to stay sober. And if I'm lucky enough to wake up with God's grace and blessing tomorrow, I'm going to do it all over again, because it tells us in here, we cannot rest on our laurels. Resting on our laurels is resting on yesterday's accomplishments. We have to get up and do it again and again and again. And if you're a real alcoholic like I am, you have to do it for the rest of your life, one day at a time, and you have to stay connected with a God of your understanding, and you have to use him, and you have to reach out. The crux of this program is working with others. Because when I'm thinking, I want to tell you something. Even when I don't think I'm thinking about myself, I'm thinking about myself. Right? Anybody identify with that? I expect everybody's hand to go up. So, I'm going to end now because I'm going long. If I'm working with another alcoholic, not only am I out of my own head, I'm working the steps again when I'm working with somebody else. The work that I've already done, I'm taking somebody else through, and I'm doing it all over again. Wow. I might have a chance to stay sober tonight. Hey, thank you all very much. I love you all very much.